This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your social media feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Vivi Ganeshanandan, also known as Sugi, author of the novel Brotherless Night.
And I'm Ivy Pakoda, the author of Sing Her Down, among other novels.
Ivy, it's great to have you with us. My co-host, Whit Terrell, has today off, which is too bad because, like me, Whit went to Iowa and he was following the exploits of their star basketball player, Caitlin Clark. He would also want me to mention at this juncture that he played D1 soccer. I, on the other hand, am more of like a more of a fan than a player. But did you watch Caitlin Clark at all?
I sure did. My mom is a huge college basketball fan. She's a UConn fan, so it was a little challenging some of those games for her. But I did follow the her amazing season that's probably never going to be topped in our lifetime.
It has been astonishing to watch her. She's just riveting. So we wanted to spend this episode discussing her outstanding and attention-grabbing career. She's been shattering records and just really prompting people to watch sports and I think maybe to think about women athletes in a different way, which is a lot of fun for me as kind of like a sports fiction junkie and kind of like a sports junkie of like someone who really loves to watch and to talk about sports. And I'm thrilled that you're here to do this with me because, listeners, Ivy is the author of the critically acclaimed novels These Women, Wonder Valley, Visitation Street, and most recently, Sing Her Down. Sing Her Down is a finalist for an LA Times Fiction Prize. These Women was also a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, the Edgar Award, the California Book Award, the McCavity Award, and the International Thriller Writers Award. Ivy has written and done all of that and was also, bonus, a D1 and professional squash player. So to talk about sports writing with an athlete who is a writer is really exciting, and we're thrilled to welcome you to the show. Thanks for being with us.
I'm so excited to be here. I love talking about sports and fiction. It's one of the things I rarely get asked about. So people get asked me about sports, but they don't ask me about the overlap of sports and fiction. And I'm so excited to have this conversation.
Awesome. Well, going back to Caitlin Clark, she's been breaking not only scoring records, but attendance records. Like wherever she plays, attendance spikes. If the Iowa Hawkeyes visit another school, like at Wisconsin, there were 12,000 fans out to watch her, which is like more than three times the average attendance at women's games there. Fox Sports has, I recently discovered, a Caitlin cam. Is this like, from your point of view, does this seem like specifically something about Caitlin Clark? Or is it something about women's basketball being more interesting than men's right now? Like, or is there like, are we changing the way that we watch women athletes in general?
You know, I'm not exactly sure why. I mean, I know why her story is huge because her, records she's setting this year are sort of transcendent. I live in Los Angeles and the LA Times covers UCLA women's college sports in the paper. So, you know, especially women's college gymnastics, the women on the team at UCLA are sort of names that people will recognize and open the paper to read. So it's not completely unusual for me to see female athletes being lauded. So, you know, publicly, college athletes, it's great to see. It's amazing. I have a friend whose 11-year-old son is riveted and obsessed with Caitlin Clark. He lives in Brooklyn And he has no affinity with Iowa or women's college sports, but is following that story. So I just think her story is reaching a whole bunch of people. I think it might be something to do with the media finally paying attention to women. The women's NBA, the WNBA, is sort of picking up steam with like Sabrina Ionescu, who's also super famous at the moment, which is great. And maybe like Brittany Griner's trials and tribulations sort of allowed people to really think about female athletes, college and professional, as human beings, as opposed to like in the shadow of male athletes. So I think it was kind of a really great moment for people to sort of focus on this. But also the story is just, it's epic. And I don't think we're going to see something like this for a really long time. And it's so exciting to see, you know, how many people are attuned to it.
She broke a bunch of scoring records. And This was the thing that was most recently super fun to watch. But last year, she kind of became a star during, I guess, like March Madness last year. And the narrative that sort of took off was about Iowa playing LSU, which of course has a star of their own in Angel Reese, who is also just incredibly fun to watch. And the two of them have been playing each other for years and years. And then there was, it's always interesting to watch how, like, the ways that sports writers and just culture characterize, like, women's conflict or create conflict with between players, like the ways that arguments with refs or umpires are characterized, the ways that aggression is characterized. Because, so the incident that I'm talking about here is that, like, Angel Reese trash-talked Clark during a game. LSU won the national championship, and Angel Reese made the kind of like, can you see me now sign. And then like after they won, I think like pointed at her ring finger, and there was like immediately a spate of like Twitter hot takes about like how could like Angel Reese did this, and it's so classless. And Caitlin Clark is a consummate trash talker herself. It's like actually one of the reasons it's really fun to watch her. So like, do you think that we're like, are we changing the way that we talk about how women are aggressive in sports? Like, because after these hot takes happened, Clark, to her credit, was kind of like, I have no problem with what Angel did. Like, we're athletes, and kind of this is a thing that we do, and we're friendly, and this is fine, and you guys should not be criticizing her for this.
I think it's unfortunately, no, we're not actually changing the way that we talk about aggressive women on a playing field. I follow tennis really closely, and I also as a professional athlete. And I think one of the things that we expect from athletes, especially female athletes, is to sort of restrain themselves in this sort of hot box setting. You know, all the focus is on them. There's adrenaline, there's, you know, pressure, there's the crowd, there's, you know, anxiety about winning, losing, performing. And then we expect that, you know, within this sort of, you know, microscope pressure cooker, that they're going to sort of behave. I'd like to think about, you know, Serena Williams at the US Open, where she yelled at the lines person. It's, you know, she was treated like she was a savage. And what I think is unusual is to be able to keep it inside and be able to sort of perform quietly and placidly, despite, you know, all the things that are swirling around, all the history that Serena was experiencing at that tournament, where she's notoriously been on the losing end of many calls. I think we don't allow female athletes to be properly aggressive. And what is acceptable for a male athlete is still not acceptable for a female athlete. I think the fact that we talk about male and female athletes in separate categories is part of this problem. I think, you know, trash talking is awesome. I think it's really fun. I think I cannot speak to whether Caitlin Clark or Angel Reese trash talk naturally or whether it's partly performative, but it does sort of draw a lot of attention, and it makes the game have a dimension outside of just, you know, the athletic stuff. I think it's normal. I personally love it. I love that side of sports. I wish sports were even more colorful. I don't like cheating and I don't like pointless aggression, but I think stuff like that gives it nature and nuance and also allows people to understand exactly what an athlete is going through, you know, that it can't just be playing the game, that there's emotion that cannot be contained by shooting the ball, dribbling the ball, hitting the ball, whatever it is. And I think stuff like that's only natural. Like, point at your ring finger, say that you're going to be the champion, like be like proud and aggressive and be, you know, be challenge yourself and want to be, you know, the best you can. And like, let someone know. I think it's awesome.
So we're going to talk a little bit later about your time as a player, and I'll be curious to hear how that went for you. But I also am a longtime tennis fan. I'm not really good at sports, but if I'm good at any sports, I'm only passable. Like, I'm passable at racket sports and in anything else. You know, there's like a lot of work going into whatever's happening. But so like with racket sports in particular, like you mentioned tennis, and for a long time, like tennis, right, is coded as like this elite upper class sport and right, like a ladylike thing for women to play. And I remember as a kid watching like Martina Navratilova versus Chris Evert and rooting so hard for Navratilova because she seemed to not be following the rules of kind of ladylike behavior, which I really appreciated that she was. And of course, like I think at the time that I started watching her, she was in the closet. And there was also like a lot of maybe coded homophobia being like launched in her direction. And I sort of, and Chrissy Evert was like America's princess, which of course also, I mean, I suppose I shouldn't have held that against her. She was under a lot of pressure as well. But do you remember watching them?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. I have come around on Chrissy a lot recently. I think she's changed. I think she's grown up. There's a really interesting documentary on the BBC about the legends of tennis. And one of the stories is about Chrissy Evert and Martina's rivalry. And it's sort of, Chrissy talks about how she was sort of packaged as that. And she was sort of the antidote to this sort of, you know, not openly, but quite visibly gay or more sort of non-traditionally feminine athlete. And there was a lot of pressure on Chrissy to fulfill that role. And I didn't quite understand that. And she was naive and she was young and she really played the part. And she, I have to say, in the last couple of years, she has really grown, in my estimation. Her opinions have become much more progressive. She and Martina are really good friends. They wrote this amazing op-ed in the Washington Post about surviving cancer together. And they're two of the most visibly outspoken people about the WTA possibly being sponsored by Saudi Arabia, a place that is not notoriously pro women's rights. And, you know, women will not be able to attend the sporting events. I think, you know, we do love these kind of rivalries. We always love black and white, sweet and not sweet, you know, the spoiler and the sort of, you know, the traditional one. I think that's just something we crave in sports. And I think sports marketing and stuff creates them that sort of rivalry for us. And I think Chrissy, although she looked the part and was the part, was definitely scripted into that role even more than she understood at the time.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
That makes a lot of sense. And I mean, you mentioned earlier Serena Williams, and you just mentioned now kind of the ways that sports rivalries are sometimes cast as black and white. And I mean, like from a racial point of view, like often sports rivalries are specifically racialized. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how you see this affecting like black women athletes, like non-black people of color who are playing sports. Because I think about, you know, like Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, who I also like watched when I was a kid. And, you know, Clark is a white player from a very white state. Like, there's a way that this is also playing into her stardom and marketability. I mean, I say this as a huge fan of her, like, but there's definitely, like, the ways that people talk about her in Angel Reese. And we see this, of course, in other sports as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say how race truly affects her because she is, like, a true superstar. And I think that regardless of the race of whatever player achieved that, there would be a lot of fame. But I think we love, you know, we love these rivalries around race. I mean, there's nothing more exciting in the tennis world for many people, not myself, when Maria Sharapova beat Serena Williams in the Wimbledon final when she was 17 years old. People were just like, here's this, you know, pretty white woman or girl at that point. She was under 18, beating, you know, the very black, very sort of, you know, outspoken, like boisterous, American player, and this was what people latched onto. When Venus played Serena and they're both Black, people were less interested in that, although I would argue some of the quality of that tennis was amazing. I think, unfortunately, it is something that the public relishes. And I think also when we think about basketball, we don't think necessarily about white players. So I think that, you know, the women's game, there are definitely a lot of white superstars like Sabrina Ionescu, who I just mentioned, and Caitlin Clark. But I do think that people love to build a rivalry around binaries, you know, and I find it so interesting how much Larry Bird is still mentioned. He's an amazing player. I remember when I was in college, there was a woman on the basketball team briefly whose dad was a professional basketball player in India, and everyone would call him the Larry Bird of India. They would say, you know, her dad was the Larry Bird of India. And I thought that's so interesting. There's so many players they could draw from for that comparison, especially because her dad is, not white. Why are they making this comparison? Why is this the acceptable comparison? So Larry Bird sort of stands in my mind, although he's a great player, for some kind of thing that's acceptable and respectable. Whereas, you know, Magic Johnson comes with some issues. Michael Jordan comes with some issues. You know, Kobe Bryant comes with some issues. I think we sometimes have these like white touchstones that we like to refer back to. Like people are still, you know, use Chrissy Everett as sort of some tentpole of like, you know, female tennis behavior. And, you know, I don't think it's anybody's fault, but I do think, except for the media, I think we have to move away from that. But it's definitely part of the culture. I see it in tennis still. I mean, I follow tennis obsessively.
So, I mean, as one example of like just the historical ways that this works, right? The NCAA did not recognize women's college athletics back when Lynette Woodard, who was a Black woman who played in the late 70s and early 80s, and she scored 3,649 points. And so Clark did not break that record. Lynette Woodard has spoken publicly in praising Clark. And there are other records like this, like Pearl Moore scored over 4,000 points for Francis Marion College in the late 70s, but the school wasn't D1. So there are all of these like ways that the history around how Black women's participation in sports was recognized, or like how women's athletics in general were recognized. And so there's always these like of asterisks of like, oh, like this league was amateur and like this league was professional. Right. And these comparisons are like, to some extent, it seems like comparison is, of course, like people are competing with each other. Like one of the ways that we understand and appreciate narrative in sports. And then also when you look at women athletes, like the way that the history has worked kind of makes that those comparisons really, really hard to make. Like people will sit around being like, I wonder if Jordan had played LeBron, if they had played against each other in their primes, like what would that have been like? And I don't hear quite like that kind of deep historical understanding of women's athletics pervading the narrative yet. Like we don't sit around being like, what if Caitlin Clark had played against Rebecca Lobo? I mean, maybe I do, but like, you know, it's not like in the popular, it's probably not in like mainstream sports right. chat.
I mean, The only example I can think about that, and going back to tennis again, is Serena Williams and Margaret Court. Margaret Court, who is a much older and incredibly homophobic Australian tennis player. She holds the record for the most major wins, 24. Serena has 23. Serena came so close to breaking that record. She made 6 finals that all she needed was to win one of them post having her child, which, by the way, is an amazing feat to make 6 major finals after having a baby. I mean, that's more impressive to me than winning them at one of them. I mean, not more impressive, but like that is equally impressive. Margaret Court is going to hold that record forever. It was a different era. It's not even comparable. It's not even on the same, you know, it's not the same sport. But she holds that record and she will always hold that record. I can't really foresee anyone coming along in my lifetime who will shatter it or break it or come close. But it's always going to be this weird thing in the record books where Serena, who's probably one of the greatest tennis players of all time, will not have that, you know, accolade because this older white lady who played a more patty cake game and also is visibly outspoken about anti-LGBTQ rights and has a stadium named after her in Australia. you know, is going to hold that. And I think that's the example where we do need to sort of look at the evolution of the sport to really, you know, reconfigure who is the best. Basketball is a little different because you have a whole team around you, and the evolution of the game is a little harder to see, you know, from the naked eye than tennis, which, like, the balls are, like, the rackets are different and the speed is different. So, yeah, I think also, like, the history of women's sports has not been entrenched in the public consciousness enough to build these rivalries in people's minds. I think we need a little more work to be done for these to be household names. I think the average person does not have the comparison basis for Caitlin Clark. They're like, she's just really good.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
So I want to pivot here because you mentioned Kobe Bryant a little bit earlier, and you had a special relationship with Kobe Bryant. You co-wrote a YA novel with Kobe Bryant, and
two YA novels
novels with Kobe Bryant. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you can read us a little bit from that book and talk about that experience a little bit, what it was like to be an athlete writer working with Kobe Bryant as a co-author. And the YA novel is called Epoca. Am I saying it?
Well, he said Epoca. We said it differently, but okay. That's okay. You know, Kobe really wanted to. He spent the last year of his NBA career sort of sidelined a lot of it because of injuries, and he was building this fantasy world in his head that was sort of like Game of Thrones, Harry Potter, and professional sports, or kids' professional sports, and he really was interested in. He was sort of interested in what gave him this, what he considered almost a superpower to do these like nearly inhuman things on the court. And I think he felt a little guilty and a little that he had something that other people didn't. So he created this world in which there was a magical power named Grana. He said Grana. We would do events together. We would say it differently. It was really strange. He grew up speaking Italian. So it was always like he had this Italian accent on a lot of the words. So in the book, which is sort of the best way I can describe it briefly, is it's sort of a Greek, like we created our own pantheon of sports gods, like Greek gods. And it's set in sort of a Harry Potter type sports academy, loosely based on ancient Greece. But it's in this world, all the kids or everyone gets this Grana power around 12, 13, or maybe even 10. And that's what makes them elite in their field. And it could be anything from medicine to sewing to painting to sports. And we were focusing on sports. So in the passage I'm going to read, the young princess, Preisha, there's two characters. There's Preisha and Rovi. Preisha is a princess and Rovi is a sort of street kid from Northern Africa. And they're going to meet at this academy. And this is the scene where Preisha is very worried that she's not getting her Grana. It's her birthday and her sort of nurse babysitter confidant has given her a very cool pair of sneakers. And her nurse's name is Anara. Okay. Preisha was holding in her hands the most beautiful pair of golden sneakers she had ever seen. A pair of Grana gleams. Anara, she cried, flinging her arms around her nurse. Thank you. Aren't you going to put them on? Preisha slipped on the golden shoes. They fit like they had been made for her, which they probably had. Many centuries ago, not long after the gods granted us Grana, a merchant was traveling to the country of Tanis in the continent of Akbulian and returned with a barrel of their most sacred rubber, Anara explained. The soles of these shoes are made from the last rubber left from that barrel. Only 20 pairs were produced. The shoes felt cool, like quicksilver. The golden leather sparkled in the late afternoon sunlight. Preisha sat back down on the bed. So what are you waiting for? Anara asked. They're beautiful, Preisha said. They're the most beautiful shoes in the world. But what? What's the point of running shoes if I don't have Grana? Preisha asked. Anara stroked Preisha's hair again. Preisha, your Grana will come. That's what everyone keeps telling me, Precia said. And it was true. Everyone was concerned with Precia's Grana, from the members of the High Council to the Epic priests, down to her own parents. Because she didn't have Grana, she couldn't rule Epica. This law had been written ages ago in the scrolls of Epica, the contract between the gods and men signed in exchange for peace in the land. But Precia cared less about that than she did about one other thing. No Grana meant no sports, because without Grana, she stood no chance against anyone, not least of all against an epic athlete. Without Grana, she'd never be able to compete. Don't you want to try them out? Anara asked. Of course, Precia said. But here was another problem. Who could she play sports with? No one. Her life was filled with dull tutored lessons on epic law and the history of the Age of Grana. Most of her days, she was left to roam the castle alone, inventing all sorts of games to amuse herself. Precia was about to explain this to Anara, but she stopped herself when she saw the eager look on her nurse's face. Come on, get going, Anara said. Okay. Precia leapt off the bed. She smiled over her shoulder at her nurse, then sprinted out of her room, down a large marble staircase and into the Hall of the Gods. The shoes felt so good on her feet. She raced through the atrium, down the grand staircase. She gave a quick wave to the marble statues of her ancestors. Then she sprinted down the steps onto the castle grounds. It was like magic, the way she took off from the bottom step and sprinted around the edge of the stadium. It was almost as if the shoes were enchanted. It was as if they were moving her feet for her. She darted past the castle gates and into the thick grove of fig trees. Normally, she would stop to pick a few of the ripe, dusky purple fruits and spit the stems as she ran, but not this time. She wanted to keep moving. She needed to keep moving. The wind blew her hair back behind her. Her arms kept time with her feet, everything urging her on, on, on. Precia looked down to see the dazzling blur of the golden running shoes speeding across the dusty clay earth, moving faster than she had ever thought possible. It was as if her feet didn't belong to her at all. What had Anara done to these golden shoes? What magical spring had she dipped them in? Who had she asked to bless them? It was as if they had given Precia superpowers. It was as if they had given her Grana. Precia skidded to a stop, tripped over a tree root, and went head over heels until she came to rest, her knees streaked with reddish dirt. What if it wasn't the shoes? What if it was Grana, finally, after all this time?
I love that. So, like, you're working on this scene with Kobe Bryant. What is that like?
Well, the process was really interesting. I mean, he was very hands-on. He sought me out personally. He, like, Googled an athlete who wrote novels and had a degree in ancient Greek and came up with me. There's not a lot of us out there, maybe just one. He cold called me one day. I got an email that Kobe Bryant wanted to call me, and I thought it was a joke. But he did, and we came up with the story together. So we came up, he had all these ideas, and there were just too many ideas. I was like, that's not one book, that's eight. And then there's these other series, and you have to hire other writers to do those because we're not writing Game of Thrones for children, which was sort of his ambition. We would lock the outline down, and I would sort of give him a rough idea of each chapter. And, you know, he was really collaborative. He knew that the writing was my job. If he ever created a problem, like he didn't like something in the book, which is something that happens when you ghostwrite, he would actually solve it. The next morning, he would call and say, I'm really sorry. I know I pissed you off last night by tearing this up, but here's my solution, which was great. You know, because obviously, you know, I would push back sometimes, but he really never left you in the lurch. But he was also the person, you know, I was a professional athlete. I always thought my squash career and my writing career could never be linked. And he was the person who sort of helped me really come to terms with the fact that sports and art are really two sides of the same coin. They're both creative and they both require the same kind of dedication, the same kind of self-belief and acts of ego. And also, like, you have to be creative on the court. You've got to be creative in your work. So he really built that bridge for me. It was in my brain, but he gave voice to it and allowed me to really think about it, which was awesome. He was great to work with. And, you know, ultimately he knew that if I said something wasn't working narratively or on the page, I got to make that decision. But the overall structure of the story and the ideas were all his.
Wow. That's so interesting. So did you discuss other books with him, like, as you were working on this? Game of Thrones for Children by Kobe Bryant is...
Yeah, I mean, that is the idea. We had eight books outlined, but he died the day after we finished the revision of the second book, which then I had to rewrite because it ended. Kobe was kind of dark, and he liked the idea that you had to have a trial by suffering. One of the gods in this pantheon of alternative Greek gods that we created is the god of suffering, which is, you know, a little tricky in the wake of what happened to have the god of suffering be so prominent. He wanted to tell kids that suffering was not as bad as you think. It's something you have to deal with, something to get through. So he really had a sort of, I wouldn't say not morbid, but like embracing the dark side sensibility as something that you needed to control. His theory was there are two emotions that are sort of at play at any act of anything you do in your life, but particularly on the basketball court. In his, fear and love. You're motivated by fear and love, the love of the game, the love of what you're doing. But also, like, if you can't master your fears, you're not going to be successful. If you play driven by fear, fear of losing, fear of whatever it is, it's going to hamper your performance. So you have to embrace the fear, take in the fear, understand it, make it part of who you are in order to be successful. And that's what we're sort of driving at here. We didn't quite get there in the end, unfortunately.
So as we were talking over this episode, Whitney and I had an easy time thinking of, at least, I mean, I think in particular, I did have had an easy time thinking of novels for younger readers about women athletes. And of course, like your novel has this young girl protagonist in it. And it's also easy to think about movies about female athletes. Like there was the Diana Nyad movie, Nyad, mm-hmm. which I actually watched last night, which was Oscar nominated this year, or like A League of Their Own, et cetera, et cetera. But it was hard to think of literary novels about women athletes, and then kind of easier to think of literary novels about male athletes. And I just wonder what you think about that. And you recently reviewed Western Lane for the New York Times, which is about a young squash player. Do you have a favorite literary novel about women athletes or any kind of theories in this direction?
It's funny. A few years ago, The Guardian asked me to write a roundup of books about female athletes, and I was just completely at a loss. They're just not a lot, you know. There's biographies, you know, there's stuff. Western Lane would definitely be my favorite. I think that the way Chetna Maru, if I'm saying that wrong, let me know. I've never said that out loud. Her capture of what is going on in an athlete's mind on a squash court, which is something I understand is incredible. And just the idea of a young girl playing a sport for escapist reasons and to come to terms with her mother's death is so, you know, I think the best novels about sports aren't really about sports, but use sports as a microcosm to examine a larger anxiety in the world. And that book does such a great version of that. That is my favorite. I can't really think of, I don't know if I've read too many books about female athletes, like novels. Let me think.
Yeah, I think so. I just got Western Lane on audiobook, which I'm super excited to listen to. And it was on the Booker. I was nominated mm-hmm. for the Booker. You know, it's been nominated for, I think, several other things. It's a debut. I'm just like, this is very, very, like, as a, like a, like, you know, I was a little South Asian girl who played racket sports. I certainly wasn't as good as the protagonist of Western Lane, but like, I can't, it's just so, it's already so immersive. And I was so thrilled to like look at the New York Times review, which I really appreciated your review. And I also was like, what a great assignment. They found the squash player to review Western Lane. And I was like, oh, I love that. I love that.
I pitched it to them.
Ah, okay. Perfect. But like, I'm also, because I noticed also that,
I don't think they were going to cover that book.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that you pitched it to them because look at how well it is doing.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back.
Yeah.
The other thing that I noticed, like when I was like last year, Chain Gang All-Stars came out, and of course, like that's also a fabulous book. They had a sports writer review that book.
They did?
Yeah, they had a sports writer review that book. And that was interesting because, like, of course, that book has all these, like, I mean, it has, like, it's essentially like a novel that has a sports league in it. It's a violent sports league, but it's like using all of those narrative structures. And so, like, that reviewer, like, spent a lot of time talking about, like, yeah, like the descriptions essentially of this violent like sensationalized, racialized sport that is kind of invented for this particular novel, and that has to do with incarcerated sports stars of a sort. And so, yeah, it just was really interesting to read you on Western Lane, and also to read that writer whose name is slipping my mind at the moment, but on Chain Gang All-Stars. Do you have favorite sports writers of your own who you would mention as?
Like journalists?
Yeah.
You know, I really love it when sort of tangential people, not tangential, I mean, I love reading David Foster Wallace on tennis. I just like it when someone who's not necessarily a sports writer has a passion for sports and can bring a literary spin on it. I mean, I read Ben Wertheim. I read a lot of tennis journalism. I just want to mention something about novels about female athletes. I was just thinking, I think still we have this idea. We love stuff like Million Dollar Baby. You know, like where a woman is doing a sport that's a man's sport. You know, we're less interested in, you know, a woman playing squash or tennis or, you know, gymnastics, because that's what women are supposed to do in sports. But like when we get like a woman who's a boxer or a wrestler, people seem to be, we like that juxtaposition. I think those things are sort of overshadowed, like just traditional women participating in sports, you know? Just something I was thinking about when you were talking. Do I have a favorite sports journalist? Not really. I mean, I tend to read mostly tennis stuff, and it feels very like insidery to talk about who I like in that. You know, and I love reading about tennis because reading about individual athletes is fascinating to me, because it's like a totally different mentality than being on a team. And it's sort of like American politics. Like we infuse these individual athletes with all this personality, like to stand in for something, like, you know, like we have this sort of identity politics that we associate with individual athletes. We kind of don't do that as much when someone's on a team.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. And we're always sort of, I feel like, you know, we make all these inferences about individual stars. And that's why I think like tennis journalism is really interesting, because sometimes it debunks that. Like the myth of, you know, Roger Federer being the consummate gentleman or whatever. I mean, he is, but also like that's what we decided, because that's the way he looks on court, you know?
Right. Like I remember watching, there was that Borg McEnroe movie with like Shia LaBeouf as McEnroe. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, oh my God, like Borg had a temper as a kid, you know, like, which I kind of had read about, but hadn't pictured in quite the way that it is in that movie. But there are these, like going back to the sort of YA thing, as I was thinking about this, I read like a massive amount of sports fiction as a kid. And like a lot of it was fiction with like a feminist bent to it, like a girl overcoming like sexism to perform really well. Like I'm thinking of like Chris Crutcher novels or R.R. Knudsen novels. R.R. Knudsen had this series where there was this sort of like quite, like looking back now, I kind of understand. I think she was like coded as a quite queer kid, or like sort of a butch presenting girl who like played on the boys basketball team because they didn't have a girls one. And then she like trained in a different book. She trained for the 1984 LA Marathon and ran it. And like that series was really fun to read. Just like in every book, she would train for a different sport. And she was such a generally excellent jock. And so I was always kind of looking on the page for the equivalent of the sports montage. I love a sports montage. And these books are so great, but they also come in the wake of, like, I remember also reading a book where there was, like, another series by a sports writer named John Tunis, and each book was about a different sport, but it was mostly male athletes. And finally, there was a book that was about a woman athlete. It was a tennis book, and I was so excited. And I'm going to spoil this book for everyone listening to this episode. At the end of the book, she leaves the Wimbledon final, which she's poised to, like, win, to go and get married to like someone who basically is sort of like, you can't play tennis and be with me. And I like,
Jesus,
I know. I was like, I mean, I've never been so mad. Like, it's probably the book that I was maddest at as a kid. I was like, this is outrageous. This is even what? And the book was just so old. So like, there's this legacy of children's books about sports where it sort of like really is, well, you know, young women, you can't have it all. You can't pursue your dream of being an athlete and get married. And like now we have, of course, like Serena Williams in six finals after having had a child, which is it's nice to see some of these tropes and stereotypes get busted both in fiction and by the athletes themselves.
But there's still not enough. I mean, when Kobe and I were doing these books, like we were looking at the sort of landscape of young adult or middle grade sports stuff. And there's just, you know, the characters in the books are are based on his kids. They're mixed race kids. And Jason Reynolds is the only person that is coming to mind who really does an amazing job of marrying the idea of sports to, you know, race and struggle. And have you read those books, his track books?
I haven't.
They're incredible. Oh, they're sort of like the industry standard. It follows like a different kid on an inner city track team. I shouldn't say inner city, but like a school that, you know, doesn't have a lot of resources. And each book is a different participant on that team sort of journey, and it's a different struggle. And they're amazing. Kobe just didn't feel that his daughters, unfortunately, the kid, one of the kids in this book is based on his daughter, Gigi, who passed away with him. Not unfortunately, but it's just hard. It's sometimes hard to like read it. He didn't really see even enough representation of sports and like this idea that it's okay. Like the book you're talking about, it's okay to try and it's okay to excel. Like even now when I coach female athletes, I coach junior squash sometimes, coach my daughter, and I see still this attrition at like 14 where girls start to think about maybe sports is not the best way for me to be in the world. And it's so depressing. You know, this idea that when girls are going to high school, like there's a huge drop off in sports participation. And I think fiction could really, you know, more positive stories about girls in high school playing sports, you know, about them excelling and it not being unusual. I think like there's still an otherness about young female athletes that we could do without, you know?
Yeah, it's funny. Like when I think about like formative experiences I had, I've definitely mentioned this writer on the show before, Ellen Emerson White, who wrote these books that were about the teenage daughter of the first woman president. And like the teenage daughter of the first woman president is also a very serious tennis player. And like, I don't know, just like there were so many sports in the books that I read, and those girls were often surrounded by boys. When I trained as a tennis player, like I trained at the place in town that was like where the boys trained. And I wasn't good. So I was like I was basically training there because like my brother had trained there and my parents didn't feel like switching mm-hmm. places. And so I was sort of like surrounded by like a certain kind of, like I think both in tennis and music, I was often surrounded by like patriarchy. In a way that was really formative and that I think affected me later as a writer. And you were talking a little bit earlier about like discipline and practice and art and sports being two sides of the same coin. And I wonder if we can close out our discussion by hearing you talk a little bit about how you became a writer, how that intertwined and intertwines with your life as an athlete.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, it's like an ever evolving process where I find these things getting more and more like intrinsically linked when I think back on my career. So, you know, I was a great squash player as a kid and in college. I really wanted to play professional squash after college because I wanted to travel and not have a desk job. And, you know, I moved to Europe to train, and I played in the World Squash Tour and I played for the United States national team for 5 or 6 years. But, you know, I mean, I have a pretty good education. I'm pretty literary. I was aware back then there wasn't like the support system that the U.S. team has now for training. And it was really hard to support yourself, though we made it work. But I was aware that it wasn't fulfilling for me entirely. And I wanted to do something at the same time. You know, I decided to write a novel, which I knew nothing about. You know, I mean, I read consummately through middle school, high school, and college, but mostly I read a lot of books that weren't assigned because I sort of preferred them. You know, it's like always reading fiction, my own fiction. And, you know, I started writing and I realized the disciplines were really similar. Like, you have no one to be accountable to but yourself, you know, and like that's at the most basic level. And I imagined, you know, I learned over time that both of these things are complete acts of ego. Like if you step on court and you don't imagine you're going to win, there is no point in being there. I mean, I had trouble with that because I often imagined I was going to lose and panicked about it. I was like the epitome of Kobe's fear. Like just, I was dominated by fear when I played. But when I write, I'm completely not. And I know this is going to come across as completely arrogant, But I do believe, and I teach my students this, like if you do not think your book is good or your writing is good, I mean, not immediately because you have to work on it. If you do not think the end product you're going to create is worthy or worth people reading, you might as well not sit down in that chair. And I wish I'd brought that attitude towards my squash. I now do when I practice, like with these, in the over 45 court and play league as I play. And well, I play younger people too, but I think, you know, the idea that, and also I think it was from being female too, like this idea that like you're worthy and what you're saying is important. I guess I put all of that emphasis in my writing later on as I got older. But you know, it's hard out there to be a writer and an athlete. There's so much criticism. There's body criticism. There's body shaming. There's reviews. There's, you know, bad reviewers. There's people who just want to, you're a target, like either on the court or on the page. And I think doing both those things has sort of inured me to criticism. I just don't care. I know that I'm good at what I do. I know that I'm the only one who's going to do what I do and no one's going to do it for me. And I've chosen this weird life where I just have to be responsible to myself all the time. And like when I don't feel like doing something in one of the two fields, if I don't feel like exercising today and I don't feel like writing, I can think about the whole picture and I can think about, you know, what it's going to mean to not show up that day. And I know this sounds like a little self-help TED talk, but it is sort of very motivating. But also like there is this overlap in creation, like in a squash rally, for instance, like you can't just be boring and like, it's not, I'll do it in tennis because most people understand tennis. Like in tennis, like you can't just hit baseline shots all the time. I mean, there's going to be that person who comes along who's like Carlos Alcaraz, who's all of this variety and it's so exciting. And like, and on the page, you can't just write description or you can't write action only. I mean, in literary fiction and action thrillers, you can write action, but you also have to, like, you have to be creative. You have to have a setting that's like more interesting than like the average thriller. Like that's why certain books get sold and other ones don't. They have something. So you have to have a toolkit both on court and on the page, and you have to develop all these tools. And I love thinking about this, and I love creating like a scene like a squash rally or a tennis rally. Like I'm going to lure someone into this idea of that they understand what's happening and then abruptly switch paths, or like have a bunch of like really long sentences and then intersperse it with short sentences, like so like varying the pace. I just think there's this incredible overlap that people don't recognize, and like, and I think that if you extrapolated this into anything, like, you know, when doctors or lawyers write books, there's definitely an overlap of their profession with the book. And I think this is something that's not quite explored enough, and this is sort of what Kobe was talking about with his grana, is like this is your skill that you are specifically using for this one thing, but it sort of influences everything in your life.
That's great. I love that. The idea of reminding oneself that like you have chosen to do the thing that you're doing and that it's gotta, you have to feel good about it to pursue it. So I think that is like, I mean, it's the TED talk I wanted to hear. So,
and oh, I'm God, sure, I hope
that. No, I think, I think our listeners are really going to, our listeners who are, many of whom are writers, probably most of whom are writers, I think will also appreciate hearing that. So Ivy, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And listeners, don't forget to get Sing Her Down and Ivy's other books, which are available in your local independent bookstore. And you can watch Caitlin Clark and other women athletes in the NCAA tournament. That is Caitlin Clark, all-time Division I leading scorer. Ivy, thanks again for your time. We really appreciate it.
Oh my God, thanks for having me on. This was a real treat.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Anne Kniggendorf. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done it yet. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll also post that show page with links to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can find video of our interviews at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and IGTV channel, and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where our back episodes are grouped by topic areas. Happy reading!